Lecture 21, Heidegger's Politics and Legacy.
Whatever else we do, all of us also live ordinary lives. Ordinary lives in the world. And it must well be the case that often questions about life's meaning don't even come up. Perhaps it's because those sorts of questions don't trouble us, or perhaps it's because we're not quite aware that such questions matter. We can reflect now, as we've taken our journey together, on the notion of creative activity. What Nietzsche would have us do is become creative and become creators of ourselves. And whether we would be noticed in doing this in the shaping of ourselves creatively, we would find meaning in life. And of course, grandly, Hegel thought that some people would not just do that. Their creative activity would define an age, a stage in the development of the history of the spirit. Well, what about ordinary life and philosophy? Can philosophy be said, like art, to lift us and enhance us out of ordinary things? Can philosophy be seen as a means, an avenue to an enhanced living? Well, philosophy's done many things over centuries. We know that at its best, and it is the way the history of philosophy chooses to view it, philosophy begins in wonder. And it becomes a reflection on cosmic systems and our place in the cosmos. And then, during a long period of Western philosophy's history, it became a handmaiden to religion, a way of helping theological concerns get clarified and articulated. But what's most concerned us in our relatively grand sweep over 200 years and more of European philosophy, is to see in the midst of the unusual, the strange, the complicated, the clear and accurate, unclear and inaccurate, the clear and whatever things that these philosophers have said, whether in the midst of that we also find some suggestions for ways of life that could lead us toward meaning or help us better understand that meaning should matter to us. Now, this could be done as a private activity anyone could do as an individual, someone in philosophy or outside of philosophy. But there's an important question. Should it also be done in such a way that it would draw in and make people who read it part of the pathway that it suggests? And in Heidegger's case, that is a very, very problematic question because of aspects of Heidegger's philosophy into which we have not yet gone, but which are very fundamental and make him not just controversial, but deeply, deeply problematic. Some have said that meaning questions are not solved through our finding answers, but they're solved if the questions go away and we no longer need to ask them. This would not apply as we work now through Heidegger, because however we might view Heidegger, he forces us to take some problems of the sharing of philosophy and the using of philosophy to guide our lives. He makes those very problematic issues. Heidegger's philosophical status took three major turns by the mid-1930s. Something quite unusual in the normally somewhat hermetically sealed world of philosophy happened when Heidegger emerged. His early status included the routine, some controversial things, but he became rapidly popular. The routine was that he did routine work, published a few things, as was expected, and over time became a kind of prodigy and prime assistant to a very famous German philosopher named Edmund Husserl. And Heidegger did what some would say was journeyman-like work, though he was the favored young professor of the older Professor Husserl. Some would say, nonetheless, he did sort of journeyman work. But Heidegger got caught up in the phenomenological claim that one must get to things themselves, not just to textbooks, not to abstractions regarding things. One must somehow get to things themselves. And this sense that you had to get to things themselves was fueled by a kind of religious background that he had. And though he was raised a Catholic, he read key Protestant thinkers such as Martin Luther. And he got caught up in the notion that there were decisive moments in life and decisions that had to be made, and that the actual life work of the concerned person in the world had somehow not just to be reflected on, but to be described. And Heidegger came to take then, having been the apprentice to Edmund Husserl, having done journeyman work, having come along pretty well, he took a very negative view toward academic philosophy as it was being practiced by a group of people referred to as neo-Kantians, that is, followers of the philosopher Kant. This philosophy, which in part his mentor Husserl was engaged in, was very conceptual, not experiential, very much caught up in the analysis of concepts. And it was also construed as excessively concerned not with problems of life, but with problems of how we know and how the inner mind connected with external philosophy, the external world. Heidegger came to be viewed, because of the way he was as a lecturer in a classroom, he was viewed by Hannah Arendt, herself a famous person over the years, as the great uncrowned king of thought. He had a sincere intensity to him that drew listeners from all over the German-speaking world. He was construed as pursuing what really mattered and somehow actually bringing this to life. Now, in the middle of the 1920s, in fact, in 1927, his major work was published called Being and Time. That work concerned itself with the issues we talked about a few lectures ago: authenticity, inauthenticity, death, your historical circumstances, whether philosophy could find a way to stop dealing with technical conceptual problems and turn to the real world of human experience. And when that book was published, it got extraordinary attention. Heidegger may have been viewed by students for over a decade before this as the uncrowned king of thought. With the publication of this book, he gets renown. He was first turned down for the chair of philosophy at the university in Freiburg, near the Black Forest, where he wished to live. He was turned down because of what the education ministry in Berlin said was insufficient publication. Being in Time was only the first third to half of what he was writing, but in a rush, he took that first third or half and published it. Publish or perish. He published, he did not perish, he got the chair of philosophy. And this gave great, great hope and anticipation to all those who were drawn to him regarding when and how the rest of the book would come out. There have been enormous controversies over this. Enormous controversies over whether his later writings in disguised form finish the book, whether the later writings are not the way the book would have ended, but a new way of thinking, whether the later writings are affirmations of what he said, whether the later writings are subtle turns away from what he said. The kind of watershed moment, which we've talked about a few times before, is when he gave this famous lecture in 1929, Why Is There Something and Not Rather Nothing? And when he gave that lecture, a lot of people decided it was no longer important to wonder whether his later writings were moving forward or his later writings were repudiating what he said. It came to be thought, as a result of his concentration on the nothing, that maybe wouldn't be a good idea to think about either his earlier or his later writings. But now we come to the moment of great significance as we think about the history of Heidegger the person and the history of the impact of his thinking. He became a member of the Nazi Party. And his membership in the Nazi Party and his subsequent acceptance of the rectorship, an important administrative position at Freiburg University, which was essentially a political appointment, caused extraordinary controversy and consternation. Now, at one point, Heidegger claimed that he actually only accepted this position because he could, if not save the situation in Freiburg University, at least make it less awkward than it would be if someone else got the position. At the same time, Heidegger adopted much Nazi rhetoric, and we can get publications that are translated into English of many of his public addresses. And in those public addresses, he speaks pretty positively about Adolf Hitler as the leader and embodiment of a great force of will for the German people. Now, after Nietzsche, if God is dead, whatever Nietzsche himself actually meant by saying God was dead, those who took Nietzsche to be saying there is a void out there that could be filled, and those who took Nietzsche to be saying that it wasn't just creative activity that would fill the void, but it could be any kind of activity that would be creatively strong, well, people that understood Nietzsche that way thought that quite possibly a decisive act of political will by a leadership and a group of people, that might be acting in a Nietzschean way. And there was a great worry that maybe that sort of thing was what drew some people to Hitler. And if that were the case, well, how could Heidegger, this philosopher who talked about one's authentic possibilities, about finding one's unique self, how could a philosopher like that become the rector of a university under Nazi leadership? Well, after roughly a year, Heidegger resigned that rectorship and moved away from overt political engagement. What we think officially, at least, is that he himself saw that perhaps he had made a mistake and that he had this peculiar view that maybe if he had the right relation with the official political party, that he could transform it. And of course, that was viewed as deluded thinking by many. But in any case, though Heidegger resigned the rectorship, he did not leave the Nazi Party. And he did not cease to be a member of the Nazi Party until 1945, which was the time in which I think we could all happily say there was no longer a Nazi Party to be a member of. And this brings us to a great problem. We must dwell on it for a moment. Could you be a great philosopher with ideas of extraordinary significance about life, perhaps its absence of meaning, perhaps the importance of philosophy as a means of unlocking and unfolding and opening up questions about meaning, and at the same time be a member for a couple of decades of the Nazi Party? And could you not only do that, but accept from the Nazi Party a rectorship? And could you give speeches that talked about Adolf Hitler as the leader who embodied the will of the German people? How can you reconcile those things? Well, the relation of Heidegger's philosophy to his personal life has been interpreted in three basic ways. Remember, as I told you, that Hannah Arendt said that Heidegger was the uncrowned king of thought in Germany, and that well before he became famous as a philosopher whose works were read, Heidegger, in fact, had drawn students from all over the German-speaking world because he was magnetic, because it seemed like what he talked about mattered to him, and he gave you the feeling that it should matter to you too. Now, Hannah Arendt, a Jewish woman who had at one time been Heidegger's mistress and stayed in a kind of intellectual relationship with him for decades, well after the Second World War, said that he was what you'd say in Greek was an idiotes. We would say idiot, but that word doesn't have the right kind of meaning. It means that he didn't have a knack, a sense for political things. This was a terrifically bright guy, maybe one of the deepest thinkers philosophy has ever known, but he just didn't get political things. It would be in effect saying, this is the greatest composer I've ever seen, but don't get him ever in any way near the kitchen, because he wouldn't have any idea how to boil water. And Hannah Arendt's idea was that that was Heidegger's situation about politics. He just didn't get it. A second interpretation of Heidegger was that he was a rank opportunist. And he was accused of holding the grandiose and somewhat deluded view that, again, maybe he would be capable of spiritualizing the Nazi Party and thereby becoming its guide in matters of culture and spirit. Let me pause on this in a minute. I'm trying to find now some very non-political way of saying this. Think about your having listened to me now over a number of lectures, and I assure you that I'm not anywhere near of the profundity of Heidegger, though in a good moment I might actually be a little clearer than he. Now let's say in the midst of that situation I thought to myself about our political system, and I like our political system. Let's say that I decided about our political system that what I'd do is try to connect with it. So I would lead George Bush, or before him Bill Clinton, before him Bush Sr., or before him Ronald Reagan, or before him Jimmy Carter, that I would kind of get to know them through my thinking, and maybe they'd invite me to the White House, and I would find a new way of philosophizing that would transform the American people. I think probably your sense would be that something's gone radically wrong with me. I must be some kind of grandiose and deluded person. Well, that was another interpretation of this business of Heidegger and the Nazi Party. Others, and this is probably for many the most commonly held view, is that Heidegger was simply a somewhat terrible human being who happened also to be a great philosopher. It was said by Lord Acton, it's been said by many, that great people are seldom good. Remember, let's pause over it for a moment. It was Hegel's claim that people could, in many respects, be morally blameworthy, but they might at the same time be contributors creatively to the movement of life and the very movement of history forward. And remember that Kierkegaard said that there would be a special relationship you could have with God, which in Abraham's case would require that you sacrificed your own son, and it would be wrong, but if God commanded it, it was the important thing to do. Well, let's come down out of these circumstances and look at the view that Heidegger was a nasty piece of work as a person. You wouldn't want to have him for dinner or go to his home for dinner, maybe because you wouldn't like life in the Black Forest, but it just turned out in the midst of all that, he was a terrific thinker. Could you take it that way? Or does philosophy reflect on life, and you couldn't have a great philosophy if you were a terrible person? Or life reflects on philosophy, so if your life is connected with the Nazis, if you look closely into that philosophy is going to be tainted too. The politics of Heidegger are said by some to be implicit in the philosophy itself. As we've seen, Heidegger held to the absence of enduring historical foundations of value, especially in his time, and Heidegger's notion of resoluteness, the German word is Entschlossenheit, was particularly subject to what we call a voluntaristic interpretation. In the face of a void, an act of will is taken by which you lead. At a minimum, you sort yourself out to determine what can be authentic in you, but it looks worrisomely like what you're also saying is that could be a leadership that could involve a whole people. Heidegger himself had a great contempt for the leveling process inherent, he said, in the sort of decisions made by democratic politics. He thought greatness was necessary, but we're not sure whether, when all was said and done, the political greatness that he thought of, well, it's hard to say any more than that it's hard to know what he might have really meant, opportunism otherwise, about that greatness. Heidegger also had the notion of an historical dispensation, that is, something that's given to a people as a particular destiny and mission. And Heidegger put special value on the qualities of the German language as conveying something spiritual, something which a lot of French thinkers like Jacques Derrida actually agreed with. Heidegger understood Germany as the bearer of culture in the face of crass Bolshevism, as he saw it, coming from Russia, and consumerism coming from the West. He was, in that sense, an extraordinary celebrator of what he saw to be culture, and he saw that culture moved, on his account, from the Greeks, with a few interruptions, to the Germans. Now, the judgment on Heidegger came in the context of denazification trials. A great philosopher, Karl Jaspers, was called upon in some way to testify, to give a recommendation. He was an old philosophical friend of Heidegger's, and they'd both agreed that academic philosophy had gone stale and overly conceptual. And Jaspers, who Heidegger thought should have been his friend in every way and supported him, said that Heidegger should be allowed to write, but not to teach. For on Jaspers' view, Heidegger was so mesmerizing, his ways of doing things were so mesmerizing that it might be dangerous for him to be listened to, because you could get caught up in what he said and perhaps not think it through as you should. And it was also thought by Jaspers that Heidegger had no gift for genuine critical exchange. It's true, Heidegger always talks about conversations, but he puts them in books, and there are conversations with philosophers that are already dead. He didn't have a clear idea of an open conversation with the living. And Heidegger was also accused during these denazification trials of dishonesty and stubbornness. Why didn't he come out and just admit his complicity in Nazism? Couldn't he at least have said, I did something horrible, I was completely wrong in what I did, I was either stupid or an opportunist, or I had delusions of grandeur, but he said nothing. He remained silent. Heidegger nonetheless had great influence on both theology and on literature in his career, and even on the development of therapeutic psychology. And these influences remain to a considerable extent even today. Let me give you one theological example, and that's Rudolf Bultmann, who was a professor of religion in Marburg, Germany, and in the 1920s, he and Heidegger knew each other. And Bultmann took much of Bultmann's theology from Heidegger. Heidegger had said there was a call of conscience. Heidegger had said that call came from deep within you. It was your authentic self, which you were not aware was there, calling you to nurture it, to bring it out into the open in your historical circumstances. Bultmann said, well, Martin Heidegger, you've got this in significant ways right, but you've missed something. Your own authentic self can't be calling you. That can't be the call of conscience. I accept most of the rest of your philosophy, but the real call of conscience would be God calling you. So I will be a Heideggerian Christian theologian. And Heidegger's later work, about which there's an extraordinary amount of controversy, was very influential on a theologian named Karl Barth, who some say has had the major influence on theological thinking in the last half of the 20th century in Germany. What is today called deconstruction, which is either a wonderful thing or a disease in the academic world, wouldn't be possible without Heidegger's early work. Heidegger's Being and Time, written in the 1920s, stresses getting back behind standard formulations and looking beneath conventional structures and finding beneath those structures underlying discrepancies, disparities, underlying inconsistencies. And in fact, Heidegger had an extraordinary influence on the philosophy of Jacques Derrida, very influential himself, especially in the discussion of literature. Heidegger also spawned, kind of accidentally, an alternative to Freudian and most post-Freudian therapeutic theories. Heidegger himself, after the Second World War, had a breakdown. Now, it shouldn't be a mystery that you might have a breakdown if you'd been a member of the Nazi Party, appointed by it as rector in Freiburg, had retained your membership in the Nazi Party, and then the war ended, whatever your true interviews were, a breakdown might be possible. And Heidegger went to Zurich to undertake a psychoanalysis, and he found a particular psychoanalyst in Zurich whose name is Medard Boss. And what happened is a story for the ages. By the time that analysis was only a little ways along, Medard Boss, having read Heidegger's work, decided to analyze Heidegger in accordance with Heidegger's own ideas. And Medard Boss came to believe and exercised this belief even on Heidegger that the fundamental problem we face in our lives is to face up to the fact that we will, and we don't know when, die. Our problems are not fundamentally sexual, though we may have sexual problems. Our problems are not fundamentally about power, having it or not having it, though we may also have those problems. Our problems are not just simply problems of adjusting to the world, or problems that have to do perhaps with a little more than adjustment, success in the world. Our problems, if Heidegger is right, and that's the way Medard Boss took it up, our problems about facing that, as we now are, sometime we will no longer be. And what avenue there is for determining meaning can only be in that meantime that is our lives. What about this aspect of Heidegger? Can the notion that death is fundamental and that our life only has meaning in the context of realizing our finitude, can that be the secret that unlocks what truly matters? Many people looking at Heidegger said, that's a nihilistic outlook. That's an outlook that is unable to appreciate the everyday. Heidegger would have said, in return, we live in a world that's being leveled out. We live in a world where real, genuine opportunities to find ourselves and to enhance ourselves are being given over to a leveling process, are being given over to technological ways of doing things, are being given over to a kind of ordinariness where we become, when all is said and done, and in this, he very much agrees with Nietzsche, a world in which we become largely consumers. We produce fundamentally in order to be able to consume. So as we now end our reflection on Heidegger, we should probably keep three points in mind. If we were to go along with Heidegger, we would think that philosophy is something we should realize we are not quite aware of why it is and what it could do. Secondly, we should think that there may be a void in human life connecting with which is our only opportunity to make life meaningful. And we should also think that human life only finally will have meaning to the extent that we can concern ourselves with what it would be to care and care about what it means to be.